We'll build a world of our own, which no one else can share. All our sorrows we'll leave far behind us there. And I know that we'll find that there'll be peace of mind when we live in a world of our own. That song was sung by the Seekers in the early 1970s. And if you can remember it, you're really quite old. But it is still so relevant today, for there is a deep feeling in our society that it is in one exclusive personal relationship that the individual can find security, happiness, and fulfillment, and so make sense of his or her existence. So many people believe, you know, if only I can find that man, Mr. Right, or if only I can find that girl, Miss Right, and if only we can then build the right relationship with the two C's being big enough, commitment and chemistry, then we'll find the happiness and fulfillment that our hearts long for. It is a lonely world, but we'll find it there in that one special exclusive relationship with him, with her, that world of our own which no one else can share. That is the key to happiness and contentment. And that is what makes this Samaritan woman that we have before us such a contemporary figure. This may be 2,000 years old, this text in front of you, but ladies and gentlemen, it is totally contemporary. She kept trying to build a world of her own around an exclusive relationship to create meaning and stability, and every time that world, that relationship, fell apart. So doubtless, after five husbands, which is what we read in verse 18, she'd have resonated with this little post-honeymoon ditty, "The eyes that over coffee looked so very sweet may not look so tender over shredded wheat." Five times she tried and failed. Five times. And now she's trying to build the same relationship outside marriage, living with her sixth man, hoping to leave all her sorrows and troubles behind her, but discovering in practice that the sorrows pursued her, that you don't actually find peace in that privatized world of her own. Perhaps she would have echoed the words of Marcel Proust, very cynical but striking. All relationships are in the end disappointing because you fall in love with the image, not the real person. And there are so many people who, like this woman, have a desperate quest for personal meaning and fulfillment and fling themselves into relationship after relationship looking for that fulfillment and happiness. And here is the crunch. And can I say this, having, as a clergyman, taken 130 weddings, so I say this with pain. But here is the issue. People therefore bring to marriage and relationships with the opposite sex expectations that that relationship was never meant to bear. That is the issue. Actually, we can spread it wider. It may be that people bring that expectation to a child they have, or perhaps to a parent, or maybe even to a boss at work. But expectations that that person will fulfill me and give me meaning, and that person was never meant to bear that. So here is a much maligned figure, Will Carling, writing in the Daily Mail, the ex-England rugby captain. By the way, I have a totally boring life. It's rugby and theology. It's so narrow. But anyway, here's rugby. And he's explaining why he left his girlfriend, Ali, and his three-month-old son, Henry. And this is what he writes. "I wasn't happy, and therefore I wasn't going to make Ali happy, and I wasn't going to create a happy environment for Henry. If Lisa wasn't around, I still wouldn't be staying. It's not about Lisa. It's about me and Ali. I want someone I can visit the Grand Canyon with and tell them everything, someone I can be at peace with all the time." Now, can I say, Carling has behaved badly and irresponsibly. Never am I going to sit there and condone a man walking out on his young son. But tragically, he's also a victim of a culture which places incredibly high expectations of happiness on an exclusive relationship, and what that should deliver. Here is Oliver James in his highly acclaimed book, Britain on the Couch, describing why we're unhappier than we were in the 1950s, despite being far richer. He writes this: "Today we demand vastly more from our relationships compared to the 1950s. Like addicts searching for the fix of intensity and intimacy, but ironically it is the broken bonds of love that are the greatest single cause of despair." And I'm sure that Oliver James's analysis and Carling's experience would have found their echo in the heart of this Samaritan woman. Five times she thought, this is the one. This is the dream relationship. This relationship will deliver. Actually, you know, most people stop long before they've gone through five relationships. But they don't stop because they found exactly what they're looking for. They stop because they start to accept frustration and futility as inescapable conditions of human existence. They can well relate to the 8-year-old schoolboy who wrote in an essay, "In Christianity, you only have one wife. This is called monotony." Now, as I say that, please don't get me wrong. I've prepared 130 couples for marriage, and I now find, as we head in, if I see this, well, you always see it to some degree, but if there is this incredibly high expectation that the dream's going to work out and this person is going to deliver for me, then can I say I really try and build a relationship because I'm waiting for the car crash down the line? That's the issue. And it's personal as well. In my 20s, I met my dream girl and I married her to somebody else. It was a disaster. I'd always dreamed of being 2 foot from her at the front, but I was the vicar. It was terrible. There I was at the front of church, and she was 2 foot from me, but she was at mid-off, not square leg. So that was the end of that. When I got to the bit in the service when I said, "Does anyone have any reason why they shouldn't be joined together?" I nearly put my own hand up. But what I had to learn was that you must look elsewhere for ultimate fulfillment and meaning in life. You mustn't look to a partner or perhaps to a work colleague or another relation. I'm saying in this talk, obviously, you must look to Jesus Christ, to the Galilean. My brother and sister both have good marriages. My brother's pet phrase in his married life is this: if you don't feed on Christ, you will feed on each other. If you don't feed on Christ, you will feed on each other. Here's Francis Schaeffer, a great Christian pastor and philosopher, who wrote these heartbreaking words, and I was reflecting on them recently when I was sort of refereeing a marriage breakup between a couple whose wedding I took years ago. And Francis Schaeffer wrote this: "How many women have I found and how many men who've jumped on a perfectly good relationship until it was dead just because they had a romantic conception of what a marriage should be, either physically or emotionally?" And what this passage is telling us, John chapter 4, and what I want to commend to you now is, well, what does it mean to feed on Christ so that you don't feed on a person? What does it mean to come to him to find ultimate fulfillment and meaning so that you don't bring that massive expectation to a person, an expectation they cannot be asked to bear? Well, let me give you 2 points from this passage just as we briefly reflect in this lunchtime. First of all, from this passage, John chapter 4, can we see that Jesus Christ meets the person? He's desperate to meet people. And we see here Jesus intimately concerned for individual human beings, for you, for me, for this woman. And if we time travel back to first century, we actually can see that Jesus, in order to have this conversation with this Samaritan woman, leaps over 3 insuperable cultural barriers because he is determined to meet her. Now, first of all, we see this woman, and what we've got to understand in terms of what Jesus does to meet this woman, she was a woman. In verse 9, can we see as we look down, the Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" And in that culture, to speak to a woman in a public place was to transgress a major social barrier. So in verse 27 in John 4, the disciples come to Jesus and they say, "Why are you talking with her? What are you doing?" In the synagogue, a Jewish man prayed, "Blessed art thou, O Lord, who's not made me a woman." Now, it was a desperate sexism. You are not to address women in public, and yet Jesus says, "I'm going to meet her." Secondly, she was a Samaritan. She was, in Jewish understanding, a half-caste. The Samaritans had broken off from the Jews centuries before. They'd set up their own place of worship in Nablus near Samaria. They'd intermarried, and they were utterly despised by the Jews. In fact, when Jews travelled from Galilee to Jerusalem, they normally went on a huge detour round. So they didn't have to sort of even put their feet where Samaritans had trod. Yet Jesus walks straight through the middle in order to meet this woman. And he says to her, verse 7, can we see? He says, "Will you give me a drink?" He's not trapped by social convention. So she was a woman, but he wants to meet her. She was a Samaritan, but he wants to meet her. And thirdly, she is what the Jews would have described a sinner. That is why she is, can we see as we look down verse 6, there at the sixth hour. This is midday. It is boiling hot. There is no one else at the well, but she has a reason for doing that. 5 husbands. Doubtless there was going to be finger wagging from other women visiting the well. Perhaps relations of those men, I don't know. But Jesus will have none of that. He is determined to engage her in conversation, despite the fact that he knows she has 5 husbands. She admits it, and he says, yeah, that's quite true. And he is longing to meet her. Now, what's interesting here is that if you look at John chapter 3, you'd imagine that's where all the action is, because Jesus meets a man called Nicodemus, who's a cross between, if you can imagine this, Tony Blair and the Archbishop of Canterbury. He's in the ruling cabinet, but that's religious as well. And you'd have thought that's where all the action is. And yet right next door, John chapter 4, John has Jesus meeting a promiscuous Samaritan woman. And what we're being told here is that Jesus is passionately interested in meeting both these people. And I don't know if we had a postcard or something and you had to place yourself between Nicodemus on the one hand and this Samaritan woman on the other. I don't know where you'd put yourself in terms of social hierarchy. There may be some here who are a little like Nicodemus. Can I say thank you for making time? But actually, everyone else wants you, and you're sure God would want you as well. But there may be some here who, if I may put it like this, feel a bit more like the Samaritan woman. And if I may put it like this, they're almost a touch embarrassed to be here. I mean, if this is all true, if Jesus Christ really is the man he claims to be, John 1, if he is the man who actually is God come to earth, and we read that at Christmas in the carol services, if that's true, what have I been doing all my life? I feel unworthy. God cannot be interested in me. But please remember that was the very charge the Pharisees, the religious authorities, laid against Jesus, that he received bad men and women. So your sense of unworthiness is the very condition which triggers God's interest in you. The reason Jesus is interested in me is because I am a bad man. And that's why he's interested in me. So he comes for the improbable, he comes for the irreligious, he comes for the promiscuous, he comes for the moral failure. And he's not hampered in his dealings with people by those discriminations which affect us so much. Be they racist or sexist or any other, be they low self-esteem. He is passionately concerned to meet people, be it Nicodemus, be it the Samaritan woman, be it me. And the question is, ladies and gentlemen, do you know him? Do you know him? So one, he meets the person, lastly, and let me finish with this. Secondly, he makes an amazing promise. It's an amazing promise he makes. Jesus Christ makes this woman this promise. Let's have a look at verse 9. Can we see as we look down? What do you make of this promise? The Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews don't associate with Samaritans." He answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you'd have asked him and he would have given you water." "Sir," the woman said, "you've nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his flocks and herds?" Now, can we see this is going on at two levels, this conversation? Jesus is talking about living water, and this woman thinks he means running water. And she says, "Look, where's your private tap?" And running water would be so much better than the still water of a well. She says, "Well, look, you know, I know this area, and this is the only place to get water." So she says, look, actually, you know, "Where's your H2O? Where can I get it?" And Jesus actually won't let the metaphor go. No, he actually is going to talk about living water. And so he says, can we see verse 13? "What do you make of this?" He says, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again," pointing to the well water. "But whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." So you see, Jesus is talking at a deeper level, and this is the issue. He is saying this. He's saying, "Look, I can give you life-giving water that will quench your spiritual thirst, that inner thirst which all your relationships have been unable to satisfy." That's what he's saying. Later on in chapter 7, he goes to a great feast and he stands up and he says, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture says, streams of living water will flow from within him." By this, he meant the Spirit, says John, who had not yet been given. You see, Jesus is not talking about material satisfaction. What Jesus talks about is nothing less than the very, I wonder what you make of this, than the very life of God himself poured into the lives of those who put their trust in him. And he is utterly able to meet men's spiritual thirst. And can I just say again, as a clergyman who stands before people, who takes weddings, can I say, please, you're not asking a human being to do this, are you? It is a terrible thing to do to a human being, to ask them to do what Jesus says he will do. It just creates car crashes. And actually, even if they succeed, you end up where I was yesterday at 10 o'clock, where I visited a delightful woman who is totally shattered at the death of her husband. So she's now facing that, because actually they had a great marriage, and I give thanks to God for that. But she is now in total pieces because he is gone and he was her meaning and fulfillment. I wish you could have been there and sat with me as she wept. And I don't know anyone who's put this sense of spiritual thirst being quenched by Jesus better than Malcolm Muggeridge. These words struck me hugely when I first met them. He has died for many years now, but this is what he said 40 years ago in a sermon in Aberdeen, and they captivated me, and I hand them over to you. What do you make of this? He wrote this: "I may, I suppose, regard myself or pass for being a relatively successful man. People occasionally stare at me in the streets. That's fame. I can fairly easily earn enough to qualify for admission to the higher slopes of the Inland Revenue. That's success. Furnished with money and a little fame, even the elderly, like myself, if they care to, may partake of trendy diversions. That's pleasure. It might happen that once in a while that something I said or wrote was sufficiently heeded for me to persuade myself that it represented a serious impact on our time. That's fulfillment. Yet I say to you, and I beg you to believe me, multiply these tiny triumphs by a million, add them all together, and they are nothing, less than nothing, a positive impediment measured against one draught of that living water which Christ offers to the spiritually thirsty, irrespective of who or what they are. What, I ask myself, does life hold? What is there in the works of time, past, present or future, which could possibly be put in the balance against the refreshment of drinking that water? And I want to say, with all humility, that I stand before you speaking about this because I have known what it is to drink this water, and it is the most wonderful experience we can know. It really is. And again, as I ask, do you know Christ, can I then ask, have you drunk this water? Do you know about the Spirit of the Lord Jesus Christ, which is a perennial spring of life-giving water? It doesn't mean that life is not still hard, but it is an amazing, amazing thing to know Christ's Spirit. And nothing else can plug the gap which Christ's absence in our lives leaves. And pastorally, can I say again, no human relationship can do that. And if you are expecting a human being to do that, then that is grossly unfair and unloving of you to do that. And if you're expecting to be that to another human being, then I wish you well. I wish you well. I don't know where this leaves you, but what we'd love to say is, will you come and look further at the person of Christ as he offers true meaning and fulfillment and teaches us how to get human beings and our human relationships in perspective? Oh, it won't be easy. It's amazing with Jesus. He sees right through us. You see, he looked at this Samaritan woman. He said, well, you've had five husbands. That wasn't a great moment for her. The wonderful thing about her, though, was that when he said that to her, she didn't run. She stayed there. And she said, okay, well, where do I find the water? Wonderfully brave woman not to run as she was exposed. And our hope is that next week you'll come back. But would you check out these two issues here? What does it mean to meet the person of Christ? What does it mean to find this life-giving spring of water? Thanks.